for joining us for another episode of Divorce Confidential. I'm Michelle DeLino, family law and divorce attorney with DeLino Law Group in the Seattle Bellevue area.
And I'm Amy Alpeza. I'm a certified real estate divorce specialist, and I work all over King County, specialize in helping clients who are either going through divorce or separation understand their real estate assets as it pertains to their divorce settlement. And I'm happy to have our guest today, Michael Moss. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here, Michael. I want to tell all our listeners, Michael is invaluable. There are only a few professionals like him that do what he does in our area. And he is, from my opinion, the best at what he does. So what we're going to do today is we're going to alleviate some of your fears. Because, you know, a lot of the questions people have about divorce are, what about my 401k? I had it before we got married and now we're married. And I don't know how much I get. I don't know how much she gets. And I don't know how we figure that out. And is there a way? And it puts people into like a state of paralysis in my experience. So they feel like they're guessing and they just don't even know where to start. And Michael can help with that. So I'm just wondering, Michael, tell everybody a little bit about you and tell us what you can do with separate and community property. It's kind of magical.
Well, of course, I follow the rules as much as I can. And so I follow the attorneys, you know, and the legal precedents. But anyway, I'm a certified public accountant. And for the past 20 years, I've included divorce cases along with regular CPA sort of things like taxes and financial statements and so forth. And then I started doing so much divorce work that in the last 4 years, that's all that I do. And when we talk about separate and community property, that's something that comes up in a lot of cases. It's something that I do almost every day. I have work that I'm doing where we've got certain assets where there is both separate and community property. For example, a 401k, you might have gotten married 10 years ago, but you've been working somewhere for 20 years. And at the time you had $100,000 at the date of marriage in your 401k, and now it's worth $400,000. And so the question is, well, of the $400,000, how much is separate? How much is community? So that's a report. You know, we have a way of doing it. And that's a report that I can provide the attorney to help delineate what the community assets are and what the separate assets are of the parties. So it comes up with 401ks or IRAs. It comes up with RSUs, the restricted stock units, or call them stock awards, or you might have stock options. So that's a similar case where you have an account that has, let's say you work for Microsoft. So you have an account that has 500 shares of Microsoft in it that came from stock awards. Well, at some point, similar to the 401k, we want to know, okay, there's $500,000 worth of stock in this account. Right. How much is separate? How much is community? And again, there's a way for us to determine which stock awards, you know, how much of those stock awards are separate and how much are community. That also might, a lot of times that comes up, it always comes up with the date of separation.
Right.
If you're working at Microsoft, and you're continually getting stock awards and you have a date of separation. And then, you know, after the date of separation, how do we determine what's separate, what's community? So we have a way of doing that. It also happens on the front end. You might've been working, maybe your marriage is a 5-year marriage. And so 5 years ago, you were working at Microsoft or Amazon or a lot of places that have stock awards. And you have stock awards that you received 5 years ago or 6 years ago and are in this account still. Can you get separate credit for that? The answer is yes, right. if you still own the shares. So, and another area of separate community analysis comes up with houses. That's a big thing. It's a big thing now, particularly because of how much appreciation there is. So you might've had a variety of situations with houses. You got married 5 years ago and one of you owned a house and maybe now you're living in it And, you know, it was worth a certain amount at the date of marriage, and now it's worth $1 million, which is not unlikely that it might be $1 million or more.
Right.
So the question is, okay, you know, their community may have, all kinds of things may have happened with that house. And whatever happens, we can figure out still of the $1 million value or whatever the equity is, we can figure out how much of that equity is community, how much of that equity is separate. Sometimes you've got a separate house, but maybe the community went and remodeled the house. We can deal with that. Maybe the community paid for the mortgage of the separate property house. We can deal with that. All those things, you know, can be calculated and quantified. Also, what might happen is that during the marriage, you may have bought a house and maybe you used money that was separate property. Maybe you got an inheritance, you know, from a family member, a grandparent, parents, whatever. So that money was separate property and that went into the down payment of the house. So that would also, you know, potentially we could have separate property in that house. And of course, I always work with the attorneys when I'm doing these things. I work closely with the attorneys to find out, you know, what their theory of the case is. And then, you know, can I do a report and figure out the separate community amounts of the values.
So Michael, do you work, do you get hired by clients or do you normally get brought in by the attorneys?
I would say, yeah, normally I am brought in by the attorneys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get a call. Michelle has a client and they've got a house or a 401k or whatever.
Right.
And they need somebody to come up with those values and do the reports. Mm-hmm. So I usually get called by the attorney.
It's great because it's just something that, you know, we know that this is a math problem that basically has to be figured out. But it's, you know, not what we do. So having someone like you available that can also help support our position for mediation or for a trial is absolutely invaluable. So, I mean, clients need to know, hey, there is a way to make sure that you're going to get an accurate picture of those mixed accounts that have money, you know, before marriage, during marriage, after separation. So all of that is something that, you know, Michael can really help bring to life in a way that's going to help support your position. It's just such an anxiety driver, I think, to clients when they don't know how is this all going to be handled and what is it, who does that? And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like when Amy's saying, do you get brought in by the attorney or the client? Well, I mean, most of the time, yes, definitely the attorney, because the client doesn't know where to turn or what to do. So it's like, you know, it's our job to really kind of be that bridge. But I do think, Michael, your process is really great. And you have the way that you meet with the clients and then you do a three-way meeting with the attorneys. Can you talk about that a little bit so people know what to expect if, you know, you're working on a case with someone? You actually do, even though you're brought in by the attorney, talk with the client, and that's a big part of your process. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that is it's an important part. You know, if an individual is getting divorced and they have an attorney, the attorney is looking at the whole case and there's all kinds of aspects, you know, to their case. There could be parenting, there could be, you know, a lot of other issues. But what's helpful for the process and helpful for the attorney and the client is that they're able to give me this piece of it. You know, say it's, you know, there's two IRAs or two 401k accounts that have separate, that are mixed. So the attorney can I kind of take over that part. So the attorney will introduce me to the client, you know, usually via email. Then I will start talking to the client directly. I'll talk to the client about what documents I need, and documents will be sent to me. Also, those documents also need to be sent to the attorney, but basically, I kind of take over that little slice of the case, and I'll work with the client all the way through getting a report. And then if there's questions, you know, that come up, which a lot of times do, I will always refer back to the attorney. And a lot of times we might have a three-way Zoom meet at the end to kind of figure out if there's some particular issues. Like, for example, if you have an IRA or a 401k, you may have taken money out of that account at some right. point. So we need to talk about, well, what happened to that money? Or there might be the stock account, you know, where monies are going out of the account. And again, or it might be, you know, monies coming in. A lot of times in the 401k, if I'm doing one, like a 10-year one or longer, there are monies that are coming into the 401k, like from other like rollovers. I mean, it's not uncommon to have rollovers. Well, now, you know, the attorney doesn't necessarily know that there was a rollover, you know, but I'm working on that. So I will take over that piece of it. And now I'm talking to the client and, you know, that, you know, I got this rollover. Now we need all the statements for that rollover to determine when it came into the account, how much was separate, how much was community. So I see myself as I'm working in support of the attorney. And part of that support is I'm taking over that piece for them. So they don't have to worry about that. And then when the time comes to coordinate, I coordinate with the attorney, whether it's we need a meeting or I just have a report and I give the report to the attorney and then they use it, you know, as they need to.
That's great. And that's end to end really, you know, how it works. And I think it's important because clients are involved, but this are only to the extent they need to be. And that's a really important part of the process. And then the attorney, you know, it's supporting their strategy. So it's a super important part of getting your financial house in order if you have any kind of assets. Michael, another big financial issue is maintenance, especially in Washington. Spousal maintenance is so discretionary and it's so that we don't have a formula like we do for child support. So a lot of it's, you know, who makes what and what can somebody afford and all of that. Do you do any kind of modeling that you can tell people about, you know, how you can help support somebody's position either for needing or paying maintenance?
Right. This is another area that I do quite a bit of work and always have, I don't know, three to six clients at any one time where I'm doing what would be called financial modeling. And basically the financial modeling is a way of quantifying a property settlement. Mm-hmm. And it's quantifying it in terms of cash flow reports and net worth reports. And I find that this is really helpful for clients who, you know, part of getting divorced, and there's a lot of stress involved with getting divorced. You know, there's a lot of, you know, relational distress, emotional distress. And some of that emotional distress is based on the finances. Like when we split this apart, am I going to be okay? Am I going to be able to, you know, where am I going to be able to live? Or am I going to be able to support, you know, my expenses? And so the financial modeling helps to answer that question on what will your finances look like based on different scenarios, you know, different property settlement options. And at the end, it usually provides people a certain amount of comfort to see that, you know, if I do get a certain amount of maintenance for a certain amount of years, and I do get a certain amount of the community property, that I'm going to be okay financially, meaning I have enough money to pay my expenses and I can, you know, live a certain lifestyle. And every case is really different. And I'm talking very generally because it's totally customized to the individual's cases. You know, everybody has a different amount of money. There's a different mix of how much money are the parties making. A lot of times there's a party that's not working. You know, a lot of times there's a homemaker, you know, in the situation. And they may not have worked for 10, 12, even 15 years. And they've got, you know, some kids, you know, 1, 2, 3 kids, whatever. So that's all figured in. And the financial modeling really helps them. You know, we have to come up with some assumptions, you know, about what kind of work that person might do. But we have ways of doing that. There's vocational counselors and so forth. And it's a very stressful thing for people getting divorced. And the financial modeling, in my opinion, at least, is a way of helping reduce that stress and making it a little clearer that if they do receive a certain amount, that they are going to be able to be okay and live a lifestyle that's acceptable.
It sounds
absolutely.
Well, it sounds like such a benefit for clients because, like you said, Michael, like, when people are going through divorce, they're really stressed out. And one of the biggest factors for most couples is, am I going to be okay? Right. And a big part of that is the financial aspect. And so being able to provide that clarity for them seems like such a bonus. Like, why wouldn't everybody do this, you know, or use this kind of financial modeling? Right. And so I think what we're trying to do today too, is to bring awareness around it. Like, hey, this is such a great tool that you can use. And if you don't know about it, it's definitely one that you should consider.
So Michael, do you always work with the spouse that needs maintenance or the lesser moneyed spouse, what we like we call them, either maybe a stay-at-home parent or someone that has been out of the workforce or someone that makes less? Or do you ever work with the client that is going to be paying maintenance? Can you tell us about how that would work if you did?
Yeah, I do work with the client who is earning the money. Probably about, I'd say 70% of the time, I'm working with the person who needs the maintenance. And then about 30% of the time, the person who's paying the maintenance. And the advantage for the person who's going to be paying the maintenance to do the financial modeling is it helps to create a ceiling for the maintenance, because at its root, there are several factors for the paying of maintenance. But the most basic factors are ability to pay and need. And so when I'm working with the person who's going to be paying the maintenance, we're looking at the ability to pay, you know, because mm-hmm. that person has a budget too, and they're only making, you know, whatever they're making, they're only making so much money. So I've worked a number of those cases and gone to court on those cases too. And it's been helpful, you know, to show the court, because the evidence that comes about from the financial planning is very clear for the court. It's clear for a judge. It's also clear for the parties, you know, even for the opposing counsel. And it's also very clear for a mediator to see the cash flows and net worths for the person who, you know, might be paying the maintenance to show what's reasonable.
Right. And to show to show what's reasonable and to show, you know, what resources there really are after, because here's the thing that I find, tell me if you agree, I find that people see, like, sometimes they see a big paycheck and they say, oh, this person makes, you know, $250,000 or $300,000 a year, but they don't see the expenses and they don't see exactly how much discretionary money there is left over to even be paying after they're paying what they need to pay. So I feel like it helps the mediator, it helps clients kind of see what's really there. I mean, do you agree that sometimes people don't see beyond the big number? That's what I find.
I totally agree. I have a case right now where the guy is making around $25,000 a month. And the wife is wanting, you know, all kinds of money, but mm-hmm. they have a $9,000 mortgage payment.
Exactly.
in which he's the only one that can afford that, you know, that mortgage payment. And in addition, he has, you know, there's expenses for the kids, you know, that get, sure. that's where the modeling, it clarifies, it quantifies, you know, the budget really clearly. He also has to pay his agent. He happens to work at a radio station. He has to pay his agent 10% of his salary.
Wow.
You know, so it's, you know, there's things like that. You know, I had another case where I'm working with the payer of maintenance, and their kids were very expensive. They had two kids, and they were in select athletics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't know if you've come across this, but it is expensive. Yes.
Select it's expensive, athletics. All the travel and everything.
There's the travel, yep. Yes, and they have to pay money to get into it. And so we went to court on that one, and, you know, he was making about that also, you know, per month. But, you know, the judge saw the whole picture. And, you know, it really helped to moderate what his maintenance was, because it was, the maintenance is based on, well, how much money is left over after the expenses.
Right.
Yep.
And we do, when I do this work, I focus on reasonable expenses. That's a very important part of the financial mm-hmm. modeling.
I like that.
Definitely. I mean, I like that too. And I think it's exactly, your example is great. If there's a $9,000 a month mortgage, that's almost half the money, you know?
Yeah, so after tax, it is.
You've got to know that. After exactly. tax, that's it. That's half your money. So.
Yeah, and that's another thing. People forget about the taxes. Oh, yeah. You know, he's making, or she is making $25,000 a month. Well, they're not, you're making $25,000 a month, but you're not getting $25,000 a month.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, that's a really good point. Taxes and expenses are, you know, it's easy to talk in general terms. Oh, she makes 300, he makes 50. Well, that's not what you're taking home. And the community always has obligations that are established during the community. And somebody's either going to continue with those expenses or somebody's not. And in a lot of cases, if there's a home and somebody's going to continue with that mortgage, that's got to be factored in. So that's a great example.
Yeah. And again, with the kids, you know, like going to college, you know, we'll if the kids are near that age, you know, typically the person making the money is going to be paying for the college. Of course, there's ways of doing that. There's maintenance, but, you know, just looking at expenses down the road too are important. Right.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. So Michael, I had one other question for you, and it's something that I think a lot of people who are going through divorce, especially if they're in a high asset divorce case, that they, you know, this term gets thrown around a lot, and it's called forensic accounting. Can you just tell our listeners what that term means and what that looks like?
So forensic accounting is a term used to investigate. I would call it investigative accounting.
Okay.
And, you know, sometimes, you know, there's one of the parties of a divorce thinks that the other party is hiding money, mm-hmm. you know, in some fashion. And getting into an engagement like that is very difficult. It's not easy, you know, to find hidden money. And a lot of times there isn't hidden money, but I would say that when I've taken on forensic accounting engagements, they're very costly. You know, they can cost anywhere between $5,000 to $15,000, because
wow.
basically what happens is I would talk to the client and say, okay, how many years do you think this might have been happening?
Right.
So if they go 5 years, okay, I need all the bank statements where the money is going into for 5 years. That's right. Just the beginning. Now I'm looking, and sometimes people have more than one account where say salaries are going into, or there might be a business involved. Sure. Then I have to go to the business and see, okay, how much money is he making or she making in the business, and are monies being transferred out? So I'm going to have to look every month on a statement and have a spreadsheet set up, and then show when there's some kind of a transfer, or maybe there's a check. If there's a check for $10,000 or
$5,000.
So it's very tedious. That's the first layer, is going through all those 5 years worth of bank statements, looking at monies that may have gone out somewhere and making a list of those. Then I have to go back to the attorney and say, attorney, I've got all these numbers. Can you go to the bank and get copies front and back of all those checks?
Wow.
And also a determination of any transfer. Where did it go? If it doesn't say. Now, sometimes when you transfer, it says where it goes. It went to Wells Fargo. It went to Fidelity or something. Then I have to go to Fidelity or Wells Fargo, get all those accounts and see what's going on in those accounts. So it can be done. It's very tedious. I've had many cases where I've received $5,000 or $10,000 and haven't found anything.
Wow.
What I find is the best approach is if you can look through the bank statements, just like I can, and see that there's a transfer or there's some big money that has gone out, mm-hmm. the attorney has a tool of a subpoena to subpoena the bank, if we can say, or subpoena Fidelity and get all the accounts that are in that individual's names. That is a lot more effective. And then what might happen, if that's done and we find the money, then the attorney might hire me to just make it clear for a judge or for a mediator to see what happens.
Gotcha. Okay.
But at that point, it's not investigative anymore. It's more kind of completing a report so that it's clear for mm-hmm. a third party to see what happened.
Mm-hmm. So would you say, forensic accounting is typically unsuccessful, or you just think that it's better resources used for the attorney?
I would say that in a lot of the cases, it's not very successful. And just to add to the forensic accounting or investigative accounting, that would also count if there's a wasting of community assets,
mm-hmm.
which means there's monies going out of the community in ways that one of the parties thinks it's not fair. That also is very tricky. And my experience with those cases has not been good.
Okay.
We might find money's going out, but then when we get to a judge level or even a mediator level, they're just kind of thrown out because they're looked at as being, you know, you were married to this person and, you know,
point decision making.
And it was partially, even though we know how marriages are, you know, people do things on their own, but the court doesn't want to get into those kinds of issues.
Sure.
you know, it's a no-fault state. And so a lot of times those community waste, that work is that's being done, it doesn't go anywhere. And so there's a waste of funds, you know, that could be spent in a better
way. And I would say that community waste, you know, where one party used money on something that they shouldn't have, that didn't benefit the community, is such an emotional hot button issue. And it leads a lot of people saying right off the bat, oh, I need a forensic accountant, because that's kind of a buzzword. And I think what Michael said, for anybody listening, just keep this in mind. His first thing he said was so spot on. It's really investigative accounting, because I, you know, you could get pretty deep into this to find out there's nothing there. And you're really paying for that due diligence and investigation. So it's something that I think everybody knows the term, like Amy was saying, but it's not always, you're not paying for someone to uncover something that doesn't exist. And there's a lot of other ways that Michael's identified that to chase a money trail, basically, which we always try to do when we scrutinize bank statements and determine whether we need to send out subpoenas. So that's really helpful. I think it's just one of those things that always comes up, you know? So, I mean, Michael, we really appreciate you letting people know what you do.
Well, thank you for letting me tell them.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, it's great. And I hope that anybody that's out there listening, if you take anything away from this, just know that finances, if it's stressing you out, that's completely normal. That's what happens during the process. It's a huge anxiety driver for people, but there is a way to get more certainty. There is information available, and there's things that we can do with professionals like Michael behind the scenes to really help get you in a good position. So thanks for being here today. Michael, thanks for your time. Amy, as always, it's great to be here with you.
Yep, absolutely. All right, everyone.
All right.
Okay.
Take care. See you
next time. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.